Loading questions.
No. Right, okay. Thanks very much for putting me on the program. It's an honor to be here. I should self-disclose, I'm an economist. Is there any other economist in the room? That's what I feared. So I'm going to talk to you about what economists do about climate change and how we figure out if it's a serious problem, a very serious problem, not such a serious problem, which tends to make economists amongst the most hated people in the space. But don't fear, I think we have good things to contribute. And today I want to talk to you about how we incorporate tipping points in the climate system into economic impact estimates of climate change. And my co-authors and I, we've built a model we call META, stands for Model for Economic Tipping Point Analysis, and I'm going to show you what this model does, how it works, and maybe get you interested in using it or working with it. And it's in Julia. Okay, so it's a collaboration, that's not just me. The core team is Simon Dietz and James Rising. Simon, I would say, is the core architect of the model. James is the reason we could manage to put this into Julia. And we've partnered with Drew Schindel for a project. He's a methane scientist, and with Gernot Wagner, a climate economist. So it's kind of between climate science and climate economics, largely speaking. So tipping points in the climate system, what are they? They are, there's different definitions around. The definition we like to use is that you do a little small push in terms of emissions or temperature change and something large, discontinuous happens. Or it doesn't even have to be discontinuous, something very large happens. So there's disproportionality of impact to output. Other people have a more strict definition, but if you take this wider definition, you get a lot of things that you might have heard about. Let's just look at one. For example, the Greenland ice sheet here. It's a big ice sheet that, as the Earth warms, melts. And as it melts, it adds to sea level rise. And so for additional warming, you get additional sea level rise, more than you would have gotten just from thermal expansions. There are other tipping points that add emissions, for example, the permafrost. If the permafrost unfreezes topsoil in Siberia, that leads to organic matter coming into contact with surface air. You get fluxes of methane and fluxes of emissions, so warming accelerates. So these are the kind of things we think about. Perhaps the most pressing one or the most worrying one that keeps the scientists up at night today is the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation that transports heat around the Atlantic. And there are signs it's slowing down, but we don't really have long-standing time series. So we don't quite know if that's just a fluctuation or is that the start of a collapse. And there's no good way of putting probabilities to that. So if you're risk averse, you should say we should probably not play around with this. Because if it does collapse, we have a big problem. On the other hand, maybe it doesn't. And then what should we do with that? So what does economics have to say about this? What can we learn from that in economics? Well, back in 2017, we started work that came out in 2021, and we did a literature survey. We thought, okay, what do economists think about these tipping points? And we discovered, to our surprise, that there were more than 50 papers that modeled or estimated some kind of tipping point and economic impacts of climate change, which is very good. But then we realized many of these were ad hoc studies in the sense that, you know, you have a study that's carefully modeled and then you assume tipping points exist, so something bad happens. But that something bad was not calibrated to anything in the natural sciences. So it's basically what economists thought might happen, but there wasn't any quantitative calibration underlying those. So we thought these studies aren't really useful for getting policy-relevant quantifications. But the good thing is there were about 20 studies that did have some kind of geophysical realism. So if you think about the Greenland ice sheet, they would do a small ice sheet model emulator model or an emulator model that would emulate the larger ice sheet models. And you couple that with an economic model and you have some kind of geophysical realism. You push on emissions, you push on temperature, and then something happens. And that something is calibrated to the science fully. And there were about 21 studies, which are about, often they're about the same tipping points, so about 8, 9 tipping points have been modeled in climate economics. Now the problem we have is that these studies come from different research teams, they come from different models. Even if they come from the same model, they run under different parameters for different scenarios. So there's no way to do a normal meta-analysis where you take the individual estimates and then you do something to sum them into one big estimate, which is what we wanted to do. Instead, we quickly realized that you really needed to produce and what we call an integrated assessment model. It's a model that has a climate model and an economic model where we can emulate each single one of these studies precisely and then put them into the same framework, into the same structure so that we control the assumptions that go into that. So we can run that under consistent assumptions, under different assumptions, and see what the overall effect of all these tipping points is on economic impact estimates of climate change. The model we created is called the Model for Economic Tipping Point Analysis Meta, which is why I put this in the talk. It's freely available on GitHub. You can do whatever you want with it. And it belongs to something economists or climate economists call social cost integrated assessment models. The bigger ones out there are the GIF model by Resources for the Future that's been used to advise the US government, and the Climate Impact Lab's DSSIM model. I think it's Dynamic Spatial Climate Impact Model, something like that. And both of these are used to inform policymakers. So if someone in government wants to know what's the economic impact of climate change in 2050, they probably use one of these two models. There are other ones out there, but that's the latest generation. It's modular. They tend to be modular. They tend to be quite good at being calibrated to recent climate science. And they have other features, but for non-economists, that's not as interesting. So a word on software. So when we created Meta in the paper in 2021, I'm very embarrassed, but it was in Excel. It was not just in Excel. It used a commercial plugin because we needed to run Monte Carlo simulations. And I'm very sorry. It's very embarrassing. We knew that at the time. It makes it very hard to check code. I mean, we had put it on GitHub, but it makes it much harder to check code. It makes it much harder to access. You know, this plugin, I think it cost €1,000 to run it. I mean, when we released it, the company contacted us and said, using our plugin, would you like to do a webinar so more people subscribe to our services? And we thought, no, we'd rather work on putting this into open software. But the reason we had it in Excel is because climate economists had worked with this software before, so it's just a legacy issue. You start, and then you have some skills in that, and you put that into the next version. But we made a choice to port it into open software. I should also say there is a person, Dominic van Mensbrugge, I think, who just took the whole thing from Excel and ported it fully into GAMS, which is incredible. I mean, GAMS is not my preferred software, but he checked everything we did, and he found very few code errors. Of course, there are always some, but there's nothing in there that was influential for the results in any way. So we are very thankful for him for checking all of that. But still, we thought it was a lot of value in putting that into Julia. The reason we went for Julia and not Python, say, is because there is a big community of climate economists that live in Julia. And that's thanks to the MIMI framework, or MIMI-JL. That's de facto standard in climate economics now. It comes out of a Berkeley group, mostly David Antoff's group, Lisa Reynolds, Frank Erics, and many more people involved. And they're very, very helpful, very nice people, so thanks to them. And the reason this started to be created is that there was some standardization in the United States as a result of a report by the National Academy of Sciences of the United States on how to best advise government on economic impacts of climate change. And MIMI-JL takes some of these recommendations, or is the basis to making some of these recommendations more readily usable. For example, this is a framework that allows you to build integrated assessment models in a way that they can talk to each other, in a way that you can swap out different modules and components. And I'll show you in a second what I mean with that. So the structure of Meta is twofold. There's a climate model, and then there are economic impacts of climate change. For economists who might watch this, maybe this is an economist, it's not an optimization model. It's a model that runs scenarios. So you feed the model scenarios that have emissions of CO2, of methane, and of other forces. And CO2 and methane are explicitly modeled. So what you do is you take emissions, you convert it into concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you convert that into radiative forcing, that's the change in Earth's energy balance as a result of that concentration. And then you convert that radiative forcing change into global mean surface temperature change. So you go from emissions to concentrations to radiative forcing to warming. Very standard stuff. So far, this is basically only climate science. And the neat thing is, thanks to the MIMI framework, we can take a model that was created to standardize how economists and other emulator models use climate science to convert emissions to concentrations and radiative forcing. That's called FAIR. And people involved with the MIMI framework built MIMI FAIR, which is an exact version of FAIR, but in MIMI. So instead of us having to reprogram that, we can just take that off the shelf and put it into our model, which is great because it minimizes errors, it minimizes different climate modules, because economists shouldn't disagree on the climate science, we should disagree on the economics and check what that changes. So that's very good. So what we do is, as I said, we take emissions, we convert that into global mean surface temperature change. But this is about tipping points. So how do the tipping points come in? Well, you can add the tipping points. You can switch them on or off. Each of these modules is independent. You can switch them on, you can switch them off. I discussed the permafrost current feedback before. So what happens when you switch that on is that global mean surface temperature change gives you more permafrost melting. And then you have more topsoil in Siberia and other places in the north that comes into contact with the surface air. And from organic decomposition mostly, you get fluxes of methane and you get fluxes of CO2, and they go back up there and generate additional warming as they go back through the climate model. The same happens with this one, dissociation of ocean methane hydrates. You can think of those as kind of submerged permafrost on the continental slopes and the oceans, but this is a very uncertain tipping point, so for the most part we don't include that in the standard runs. We used to do that, but we decided not to do it anymore because the science has become less clear rather than more clear. There are other ones, like the Amazon forest, rainforest dieback, but no time to go through them all. So, as I said, we produce global mean surface temperature change. This is the climate change variable that drives damages and impacts in this model. And so, on the damages side, we start with global mean surface temperature change, and there's two damages channels, one from temperature and one from sea level rise. Now you could say that's incomplete. There might be other ones. You know, there might be things like ocean acidification, all sorts of things. But economists haven't been able to create mappings from global mean surface temperature change to these outcomes. So that's work in progress. I think there's people working on biodiversity loss as well. This is just a snapshot of where we are in economics. It's not us saying other channels aren't important. So keep this in mind. Missing channels usually means you underestimate damages of climate change, because most of the time these things tend to be negative. Not always, but many times they are. All right, so we take global mean surface temperature change. We do something that's called statistical downscaling or pattern scaling that gets us national mean surface temperature change. And then we have damages at the national level. They're calibrated to a study in climate economics, which we think is still the best out there, despite a lot of flaws. So the difficult part is in climate economics is to map geophysical change, like temperature change, to economic outcomes. We do this, and we think it's better than not doing it at all, but it has a lot of caveats. It's very uncertain, so keep that in mind. We don't think a precise quantification is possible at this point, but a quantification, we believe, is better than no quantification. Similarly, on the sea level rise damages channel, so you have, without any tipping points, you have thermal expansion, so the oceans just become larger as the water heats, needs more space. And then you have melting of small ice caps and glaciers that contributes to water, to sea level rise. Now you can add tipping points to this. So if you have the disintegration of the large ice sheets in Greenland and in the Antarctic, these melt and give you additional sea level rise. Very simple. And that's implemented here. That gets us total sea level rise. That gets us national sea level rise damages, which in the end affect consumption per capita. That's the variable economists like to use to think about how much do people suffer or how much do people gain from climate change. AMOC, as I said before, it's the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation that transports heat across the Atlantic. If that were to fully disappear, the climate of Western Europe would be very, very different and not very nice. And then we have a tipping point that just affects India, so it's a bit outside of the channel. There is a change to Indian summer monsoon variability. So these are all the tipping points we can model at the moment in climate economics, but this is by no means an exhaustive list of tipping points. It's also by no means us saying this is the right implementation. This is a meta-study for the moment, for the most part. We have taken what people in climate economics thought was the right thing to do. In some cases, we changed the calibration a little bit, but mostly this is trying to assess what climate economists believe. And you might disagree, you might say, well, maybe this component on AMOC needs a different calibration or needs a different implementation, and there's indeed work being done. So there is a really good work by two PhD students in Hamburg. They took the AMOC module here and added a different channel and refined the calibration, which improved the estimates. And they used the model for this purpose. So they forked the model, they changed this AMOC component, and they rerun everything with this changed component, which I think is exactly why we wanted to put this on GitHub in the first place. Okay. I think that's on the model structure and on what we have done. Now, I'll show you a few results before we get to the Q&A. So the first thing, the main result of this paper we published in 2021 was that if you look at damages that you from emitting 1 ton of CO2 today, we want to know what's the additional damage you get if there's tipping points in the climate system. So what? I've never presented this to non-economists. So the social cost of carbon is the damage from emitting 1 ton of CO2 today. You sum up all the damage over the lifetime of this ton of CO2 that might be in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, and you take the present value of that in terms of how much it affects humans around the world. Very complex, but basically think of this as damages from emitting CO2, but just for 1 ton. Okay? But I didn't even tell you what the absolute level is. It's just an estimate of, we estimate these damages without tipping points and with tipping points. In this graph, what it tells you is, what's the difference between the estimate with tipping points and the estimate without tipping points under different model configurations? That's why you have this distribution. There's a lot of uncertain parameters. There's some scenarios we run there. And so a positive number means that tipping points run has a higher damage than the non-tipping points run. Okay? And so you can see that there's basically no run in which tipping points help us. They almost always make damages worse. Our best estimate is about 25% increase in damages, but we think this is quite conservative, so we try to be on the conservative side of things. If you take the full uncertainty, you get something like a 40% increase in damages from having tipping points, or from considering that they exist. And we calculate about a 0.1 probability of them doubling, so you just sum up everything here, or a 0.02 probability of tripling, so it's more than 200%. That's the first result. So they matter, they make damages worse in a way that we can measure. The second is they're almost worse for almost everyone around the world. So no good news here. This is work not by us, but again by the people who've used our model. They used it to quantify future impacts, climate impacts on stock indices, and they find that climate change decreases stock market returns, and tipping points worsen that. Lastly, that's a paper we're working on now. It's in submission at the moment, where we asked, okay, what can we learn from tipping points in terms of climate policy? So if we do ambitious climate policy, does this decrease the likelihood of tipping points occurring? And we've done a paper on global methane action, so cutting methane around the world and quickly. Does that change tipping points? And indeed, we find that if you do ambitious methane action, you would decrease tipping point intensity across all the tipping points. Something between, depending on where you are, in 2050, between 2 and 10%, depending on which tipping points you're looking at. That's unpublished, so numbers might still change, but roughly that's where we are. Okay, let me conclude. So we've made quite a lot of progress in economics on how we model tipping points. There's people who do different work in this. It's starting to be integrated in conversations with the US authorities, so they're taking part of META at the moment to put that into the other models they're using. We think quantification is useful because people do benefit-cost analysis, and if you don't quantify tipping points, the estimate that's used is zero. Other people widely disagree. They say, well, if you're trying to do a partial quantification because you might not have ocean acidification or you might underestimate worst-case scenarios, that's dangerous because you make it seem like not such a big problem and it's really a gigantic problem. That's a fair criticism. So you're in this tension, should we quantify, should we not quantify? Large uncertainties remain, in particular about how economists think about impacts of certain physical change. And what has happened recently is that we have improved calibration of some of these tipping point likelihoods. The Antarctic model is a recent paper by McCaffrey Simon with one of his PhD students, sorry, one of his master's students, I think. We've recoded this thing in Julia, so it's accessible to the community now. And there are different things you could do if you're interested. First, you just fork it and run it yourself under different scenarios. You write your own research paper. That's perfectly fine. You could try to maintain or contribute or improve calibration of some of the components or add a new component. Or you could even change other parts of the model. You could add a different damages function. Say you want to study not national consumption per capita, but maybe financial stability or something like that. So you could produce a component that does that. So if you're interested, do reach out. Very happy to chat. And you find everything on GitHub. Thanks.